On that particular note, to remind members where we are on matters, you will see there that we will be focusing on codes of good practice in terms of the BBEE, and then the consideration of the submission for NCA. So, on that note, if we could check with Mr. Herman, if there were any apologies in today's meeting.
Chairperson, I only received an apology from African Allergies attending the PC on consultation meeting this morning.
We do have an announcement here. I just don't see the minutes, which we always do put on at least our minutes. Yeah. We will be adding those minutes. It's just some technical hitch in the matter, but nothing serious. Can we please get someone to propose the adoption then of that agenda with the minutes immediately after the NCA? Thank you, Honourable Hadebe. Seconded by. Thank you, Honourable Van der Merwe. Immediately they move to the briefing by DTI on the amended codes of good practice. We'd like to welcome the DG, Mr. Lionel October, who's here with us, as well as other members of the team. I'm just looking to see where some of the names are. Yes, Mr. Zapordo, the Deputy Director General, and Ms. Satchwa, the Chief Director, and then Ms. Habizula, the Deputy Director. Thank you very much. So, Ms. October, over to yourself then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you indicated, this briefing is on the proposed amendments to the Code of Good Practice, which we put out for public comment at the end of last year. Now, Monday will take you through the bulk of the presentation, but I'll just do some of the introductory and contextual comments. Madam Chair, if you recall, the Code of Good Practice are about, and the scorecard are about 5 years old, and one can say that the concept of using a, rather than sort of legislation to use the concept of a code of good practice and to use a broad-based scorecard has been well accepted by the corporate sector. And we find now across, over the past 5 years, we've seen more and more companies using the scorecard as their way of contributing to black economic empowerment. So it's at this point that we think that it's time that we can sharpen this instrument, we can focus it much more clearly, and that is the real purpose behind the scorecard. Just to recap, obviously our core objective with BEE is to de-racialize the economy and really to introduce black entrepreneurs, black business people, black suppliers into the mainstream of the economy. So I think the core objective of the vote is really to integrate black business people into the mainstream, as we say. Now, I think this slide just really lays out the core objective, and we'll come to how we want to change the scorecard. But I think the two core objectives of these changes that we want to make. The one is that we found that if people fill out the scorecard, even small entrepreneurs, small businesses, small black, have to go through the onerous process of doing the scorecard. So what we're going to introduce, and Mondo will explain how we do it a bit later, but what we're saying is for smaller enterprises, black-owned enterprises, they don't need to, they can automatically qualify for the status. But larger enterprises, whether black or white, they need to still comply. That's the one objective. The second one is really to change some of the scoring and to create some core elements. Now, as you know, the scorecard, we have seven elements, which I think can just go to the slide to indicate here. We've got seven elements, and we think sometimes, because it's such a wide area, companies' activities are dispersed. So our key change we want to make is to introduce three core elements into the scorecard. The main one we want to do and give greater control and ownership to is the two areas of enterprise development and procurement. So what we are going to propose is that we collapse those two elements of procurement and enterprise development, and Nomura will explain that we call it supplier development. But that is really aimed at, as we say, you can give black firm all kinds of supply type support, but the real solution is to integrate them into the supply chains on the demand side to give them access to markets. Because as we live in an economy, most of the trade is not between the retailer and the consumer. It's inter-firm trade between companies. So before a product comes on the Woolworths shelf, there's about 7 or 8 processes it goes through, and that is where real value addition takes place. That's where entrepreneurship and business activity takes place. So we say if we can integrate black firms into these supply chains, that's how you create a symbiotic relationship between big business and small business. So the emphasis and thrust of creating what the president calls in the State of the Nation address of black industrial class or black suppliers is really to use these elements and to shift the focus of BEE to that. The second element we have to emphasize is skills development and make that a core element. And the third one is obviously ownership, especially broad-based ownership. So in summary then, the two changes we are proposing with regard to the scorecard is to make it much more focused and to make it easier for black firms to access preferential points. I think I'll hand over at this stage to Chief Director Nomande.
Good morning, Mr. President, Honourable Members, very busy. Honourable Members, as a busy individual, that really 2011 has marked the 50th of the implementation of the Code of Good Practice, and we think that with the presidential address of the Council having been established, one of the key mandates was to obviously do a desktop analysis in terms of where are we will be in the country and how has the Code of Good Practice really progressed in trying to broaden the economic landscape and ensure that there's no inclusion. So what is noted for that analysis by the Council is that there is a significant progress in the direct equity element, as evidence obviously by the number of equity deals that have been done over the past. And I think the Honourable Members will note that we have big corporates like Vodacom, MTN, SAP, all of them doing major public schemes in terms of the ownership element. And then in that regard, what is also was noted was that there are still many of the distinctions that are not necessarily aligned to the EU objectives. I think tipping point being the triple PFA, which again we are still at a point where we need to make sure that that act talks to the objectives. And yes, in 2011 there was an interim arrangement where the principles of the EU incorporated, but that was an interim measure to try and say how do we streamline the processes. But we find that when it comes to other economic activities, the granting of licenses, entering into a public-private partnership, the rules and the approach is not consistent in terms of ensuring that BEE is actually embedded within those economic activities. And what I've also noted is that a tick-box approach in terms of implementation of BEE, and that also circumvents the issue of reconciliation in the market. And then there also was noting that the sustainable application is lacking and the progress component. So that means that when you look at the whole scorecard and how companies have actually applied, you'll find that when talking about progress approach from a horizontal and vertical approach, you really didn't see effective participation by community groups or based cooperatives. And that's the area that the Presidential Council has recommended that we must look into and make sure that we broaden and reorientate the scorecard to talk to all those deficiencies. And in terms of the board consulted through the process of reviewing the code of practice, obviously the Presidential Council was key as the recommendations came from them, sector councils, all those that are responsible for sector codes, national and provincial governments and public institutions were consulted. This is due to South Africa, Black Business Council, Chamber of Commerce, multinationals, professional associations, financial services sector and DFIs. So there was a wide variety of engagements on which to make sure that we elicit a lot of views and inputs in terms of what needs to go into the review process and also to measure what is the feedback was from corporate and all those that are responsible for the implementation of BBBE. Then in terms of the process so far, in terms of how we've gone about, on the 2nd of October, the Minister Julie launched the Code of Good Practice and were unveiled to the market. We went on a 60-day commentary which started on the 5th of October and ended in December 6th. And then we had 35 strategic consultative engagements that we did nationally, provincially, and across all industries to make sure that we explain the rationale of all the proposed changes, we get feedback, and we also exchange ideas in terms of how best to sharpen and reorient the scorecard. Then we also did a lot of engagement with national and provincial departments to make sure that there is a streamlined and coherent approach in terms of now implementing the PPA, but at the same time, embedding the principles of PPA, especially where we are dealing with the issue of granting of licenses. And then we went on to analyze those submissions, which we received by the 6th of December. And at that date, we were sitting with 550 submissions that were submitted by the public on the proposed changes. Now, to look at just the key global revised principles, we said that we never probably orientated the code to talk to the government priority program. I think issues like, you know, national growth plan, the industrial policy action, so that there is an integrated approach in terms of how BBBE is implemented and how we can use the lever of the code to make sure that we talk to the very productive sectors. And then we've refocused the scorecard and the members into fast targeted elements. And then we've always on to enhance the status of black-owned and women-owned enterprises as a DG indicator to make sure that at the end of the day, the real beneficiaries of BBBE are targeted. Because what we also noted was that in terms of the scorecard framework, there was a discussion where we find that companies that are not really black-owned would end up having level 1, level 2, which dictates the objective of what we're trying to do in terms of those key beneficiaries. So hence, then we've elevated their status to make sure that the real target beneficiaries are able to benefit from the policy itself, and then we've said that all companies except the exempted micro, companies are those companies and other members that have a turnover below 5 billion. So we've exempted all those companies and we've said that they don't have to do anything, they're automatically regarded as being compliant, and then again we've introduced policy elements as well included by the DG ownership skills and enterprise and supply development. And we've got over again in terms of refocusing the scorecard where we've taken employment equity and management control elements. These have been merged into one element. The reason being that both aspects with regards to employment equity and management were dealing with the same issues. And we found that there was double dipping in terms of how companies would score on management looking at issues of senior top and how they would use the employment equity element also to take into that. So we said we need to merge the two and make sure that we refocus companies to look at, you know, the top executive, senior, board representative, executive, and then also middle management. So in that regard, we felt that if we combine the two, it's either also to align to what the Department of Labor is doing in terms of the Employment Equity Act and its measurement. And then as indicated, we've got the enterprise and supply development, which is effectively a measure of professional procurement and enterprise. And then we've gone also to introduce minimum requirements for the priority element. The reason being that when we actually did the analysis with the Presidential Council, we noticed that there was some progress in the indirect element, being enterprise, supplier, and skills. So in that regard, we felt that we need to push and refocus the market towards those key elements because we're trying to, then we need to talk to the real productive areas of the economy. So in that regard, I want to make sure that there's meaningful, substantive application. We need to make sure that the market complies with minimum requirements. Well, what has happened also with the forecast current is it has been easy to manipulate and actually score and cut corners in terms of reaching levels 1 and level 2. But when you actually unpack the detail in terms of how companies have complied, you don't really see meaningful transformation in terms of those companies themselves. So that's how we expect them. For them to start to even score, we need to make sure that there's minimum requirements in all those elements so that we force them to do skills development, we force them to do supply development, and we force them into making sure that they comply with the elements of ownership. Then moving on, sir, in terms of those priority elements, what we propose is that all major entities will comply with the priority elements, and those are companies that are big and upwards. And then the qualifying small enterprises, which are the companies that are between 5 million and 25 million turnover, we feel that they must only comply with one, which is the ownership, which is compulsory, and then they can either choose the enterprise and supply development or skills development element. So in that regard, we're trying to lessen the burden, but we're saying that at a QSE level, it's important that we have an element of black ownership, because what we also noted as an unintended consequence of the previous forecast is that you will find that a company that is 100% white owned can score level 1 without doing anything on black ownership. So that is an unintended consequence of how the forecast works, because they will focus on other elements and try and score there without looking at issues of management and ownership. That is difficult to find that a company that is black owned will end up being a level 3, but its counterpart will end up being a level 1, which again was not the intended objective of what we're trying to do around elevating black owned and black women owned enterprises. So that's why we have actually tweaked the scorecard in the question, and we've gone on to say that less entities must comply with all priority elements because they've got the potential and the ability to deal with all the elements of the scorecard. And in terms of, we said that entities who do not meet the threshold in terms of the priority elements, they will be discounted for less. Large entities will be discounted by 2 levels down. So if you are a level 2 and you don't meet the minimum requirements in terms of the priority elements, your scorecard will be discounted and you will become a level 4. And what we're saying is that companies that have actually done meaningful BEE, those actually then should not actually prejudice them in terms of implementation, because they would have done meaningful transactions which in any event would actually help them to advance their goal. And then you said qualifying small enterprises would be counted by 1 level down. So if you were a level 4 and then you don't meet the requirements, you go to level 5. But if already you were complying with ownership, you were complying with skills development, then the counting factor will not really prejudice you as a company, because you would have met already those two requirements in terms of the priority elements. So that is effectively what the discounting principle means. And moving forward, honourable members, in terms of exempted mass enterprises, we elevated their status and we said that all EMEs that are 100% but all will get an automatic level 1 as was indicated in our introductory remarks. And we said that all those that have 50% and above will actually get a level 2 contributor status. I've been trying to make sure that we get the targeted beneficiaries in terms of access to opportunities and access to markets. And then we definitely early payment period where we said that early payment is applicable to small companies, because also what we noted as unintended consequence is that the early payment period of 15 days where you would pay your supplier and then you have to get enhanced recognition was abused by even the large enterprises. Because large enterprises don't have challenges with cash flow, but it's only small enterprises that have a challenge. So we are encouraging large enterprises within their value chain to pay their suppliers within 15 days so that they can actually have a surplus cash flow, but at the same time ensuring longevity. So that is what we try to do here, and we've actually kept the maximum point, because again, what we noted as an unintended consequence of that, companies would just make a payment to one invoice and then change the whole 15 points for enterprise development, and they would say we've done enterprise development. Hence, we have not really seen true enterprises that have been developed as, within the value chain. So that is one area we had to try and mitigate. And we've gone further also in terms of the various elements now. The ownership scorecard has been increased the points from 22 to 25. And what we've done, we've taken the representative groups. The representative groups are your women, local communities, villages, provinces, corporations into the main points. Because in the old scorecard, we had them as a bonus. So there was an outcry to say that if you're talking about broadening the base, making sure that the is oh God, I think why are group-based groups not into the main course? Because you could do an ownership group without including those group-based groups, and that way you still fall. So the issue that now, for you to get 4 points on the ownership, you have to make sure that you have those designated groups. That is one way of trying to deal with the broad-based aspect. And then we went on further to say that the compliance targets in terms of the BEA management control will be aligned to those of the Department of Labor to ensure that there's a coherence in terms of reporting timelines, whether you know companies report annually to the Department of Labor in terms of their implement equity targets and reporting their compliance. When you say for ease of implementation, it's best that the reports that they use for employment equity for the Department of Labor are the same reports that they would use for the DEI measurement of the management element. And then we've taken that as a senior level category, the reason being that what we've noted, especially from the employment equity reports which are released annually, is that we noted that most black people are sitting at the junior level, but we don't see upward mobility when it comes to senior, top, and executive. The reason is that small companies would actually focus on that category, but then in terms of the intervention, we don't see effective escalation of those people graduating from that level to the next level. So we find that they are literally stuck in that category. So in order to ensure that companies literally start to engage effectively and make sure that it is upper mobility of black professionals, so they have to focus on the top and senior and executive. So that doesn't negate the principle under the employment equity with the Department of Labor Act. However, it says under the BEA, we have to focus on the top category so that when we look at the employment equity report, we can start to see movement. Because every year we notice that there is no progress in terms of black professionals moving upwards in terms of those top categories. So that is the rationale for taking out that category, and it is something that we debated and engaged with the Department of Labor. Then the first development element, the point has been increased to 20, and we've broadened the leadership to include issues around apprenticeship, internship, and targeted training. Then what we noted under the scorecard is that companies were doing training that doesn't really enhance an employee's ability to progress within the ladder, within the company itself. So they were doing really a superficial kind of training, the one-day course, that don't really add benefit. So what we said is that looking at the national development skills strategy, let's try to reorient it and align to that strategy to make sure that we have targeted training that can enhance the employee skills so that they can be more productive, but at the same time they can have the ability to move upwards within the ranks. And then we said that the training initiatives, initially they were aimed at focusing on the fact that companies could keep points for training internally. But now to talk to the broader objectives in terms of what government is trying to do, we said that companies can start to train outside. In the sense that they can also take unemployed graduates, start to give them internships and train them, and we're no longer focused on internet so that we can address also that issue of unemployment. And this is something that has been welcomed by the market. And we've gone also to introduce an absorption target. In the sense that we're seeing companies must not only train for the sake of training, but they must train and then endeavor to absorb those people that they have trained. And for that, we said we give them more enhanced recognition if they're able to. But however, even if they don't absorb the number of learners that they train, they will not be penalized. Because if the industry itself, let's say in the engineering sector, they are able to be absorbed by other companies, then that also goes to the benefit of the company that did the training. So that is how we've actually treated that principle of absorption. On enterprise and supply development, calling on say that companies will get enhanced recognition if they procure from new enterprises. The whole rationale is that we see the supply value chain, we want to see new entities being given opportunities. So that's what we're saying, that large enterprises must start to effectively develop new enterprises and must start to procure from them. And we think that in terms of procurement, they must not look at issues of just giving 3 months or 6 months contract or year, because that doesn't help the sustainability and the growth of the small company within their very chain. But rather they must look at long-term contracts in terms of 3-year contracts. And then if you have a 3-year contract for that small supply, at least you get more enhanced recognition beyond what you would have received. That will try to inculcate the culture of supporting and supply development within the company's value chain. So that is the principle we're trying to advocate for. And then we've gone on to say that we need the alignment between enterprise supply development within the value chains of companies. So the issue of doing supply development must come as a natural consequence when doing BEE. It's not something out of the ordinary or an added benefit that companies must do, but we are saying that we need to make sure that as well as doing business, we unlock those opportunities within companies' value chains. And the government said to say that supply development necessities, obviously, we think the objective of the EU must look at the black owned, black controlled, and black women enterprises, which are EME and QSL. And that's where we want to really focus in terms of beneficiaries and unlocking those opportunities, as was indicated. And then we've adjusted the benefit sector matrix, which is basically what we gave the market as a guideline in terms of what kind of initiatives they can do. It talks to issues like stock loans, it talks to issues of mentorship, guidance, coaching to businesses, giving their business skills, financial and non-financial. So that is how we've actually adjusted to make sure that they do need initiatives, but at the same time, they focus on issues of local production to make sure that you capacity those suppliers to produce locally and give them the kind of support and mentorship that they would need. So that's the principle that we've set up here within the body of the code themselves. And then honorable members, in terms of the threshold, we have to look at what the threshold was in 2007, as we indicated that an EME in 2007 was any company with a turnover of 5 million. Then obviously 5 years have passed and we said we need to make an adjustment in terms of now what would be the cutoff, and we've actually proposed 10 million. So all companies that have a turnover of 10 million will be regarded as exempted micro enterprises. They get automatic recognition for BEA. And we think that was a very positive step from outside the government. And then we've gone on further to say that quantifiable enterprises will be between 10 million and 50 million. So those are the companies that would need to comply with the one compulsory element and then choose the priority element that they would want on top of ownership. And the large enterprises will be those companies that have a turnover of 50 million and above. And these companies don't have a choice, they have to comply with all the priority elements because we see that they have the potential and the ability to actually comply with the forecast. The economic impact quickly on how we got to the thresholds, we did an engagement with staff just to measure as to how many economically active companies we have in the market. Because you know that most individuals register companies, but those companies remain dormant. So it was important for us to have a sense of how many companies would be affected by these kind of proposed changes. And what we noticed is that in terms of the exempted micro enterprises, we are seeing at about 95% of companies that don't have to comply with scorecards. So again, kind of dealing with the issue of how we proceed and how BE must be implemented, that those companies will actually be exempted from implementing BE. And then in terms of the qualifying small enterprises, we're looking at about 3%. Which will have the less compliance in terms of the one compulsory element and then the elective in terms of the two other priority elements. And then the large enterprises constitute about 2% of economically active companies that have been registered with staff, and those are the companies that are expected to do for compliance. The adjusted levels, this honorable members indicates the current quantification criteria. As you can see there on the shaded website, we see to say that companies automatically, the entry point is level 4. So level 4 would mean that you have a score between 35 and 75 for you to be compliant. Now what we've done, we've adjusted that recognition level to between 80 and 85. The reason being that we've lessened the elements, but at the same time we give more enhanced recognition to other aspects that companies have to do, because also we have to gauge in terms of now all companies from what we see in the best analysis that they're both beyond level 4, they are all sitting in the ranges of level 1 and level 2. But again, on the face of it, we don't really see the sustainable transformation that would actually support why most companies are level 1 and level 2. So that's why we had to say, as we adjust the forecast, we need to make sure also we adjust the recognition level so that more input is done in terms of the real output that we want to see. Another one is the revised final scorecard that is put out, the market looks like this, which again is a demonstration of how we treat the original scorecard. We still have ownership sitting at 100, I mean, close to 100, and the points are 25. As you can see that we've increased the points. We've got management control, which is the combination of employment equity, is sitting at 15 points, because we used to have 10 for management control and 15 implement equity. The skills development has been increased to from 15 to 20, and then the biggest intervention, that's from the scorecard itself. The members will notice that the enterprise and supply development is carrying 40 points, which is where really we want to reorientate, refocus, and redirect the market in terms of the real interventions. And then we have the socio-economic development element, which is still sitting at 5, because that's mainly your corporate social responsibility. So that is how the scorecard looks like, the proposed scorecard. And then in conclusion, Honourable Chair, we're saying that the whole trajectory around this new regime of the Code of Corporate Regulations says we need to change the card and be supportive of its leadership, because I think it's a common sense that if we support small enterprises, they're able to generate jobs and really create a lot of economic activity. So that's what we're trying to put forward in terms of the whole. But also emphasizing to corporate South Africa that they need to diversify their value chain, because they can unlock a lot of opportunities for these small enterprises. And obviously we've done a considered effort to link with other government strategic development initiatives like the industrial policy, CSDP, the new gold class, trying to find like a more emphasis on issues of skills development, absorption, training, and various other issues that we've alluded to. And then we want to focus all the businesses on industries that result in significant job creation. Hence, we talk about refocus enterprise supply development, because we say that within that offices we can be able to unlock opportunities, but also looking at the component of local capacity, local production, and local creation. And then the symbiotic relationship within the whole entity within the course, to say that large enterprises and small enterprises must actually have that relationship to make sure that there's more opportunity, and we actually create larger opportunities for these small enterprises to be effective participants within the economy. And then what we noted, another detail from the submission that we have received so far, is that there is general support across the board spectrum in terms of the direction that government is trying to take with these changes. And what we need now is to refine the technical aspects to make sure that we have a more clear, succinct scorecard that is applied across. So that is currently where we are with the recommendations, and we are hoping that we will actually deal with all submissions, and currently we are sitting at about 200 submissions that we've analyzed. And this is, that is the end of the presentation.
Thanks, Namonde. Just in conclusion, as Namonde, we're at the stage now where we received over 500 submissions. Yes, Namonde has worked through number 300 yesterday, and we got 200 left, which we will work through in the next week or two. After that, we will run a meeting then with our principals, and then see what amendments we need to make to these proposals. So these proposals are obviously not final. We'll take into account all the public comments. Some of them are very, very, there's been some really good suggestions as well. Also, they've identified some weaknesses in our formulas on value added and so on. There's some gremlins that was in the code, so I think we'll take all that in and then come back to you as well with what we think we should put into the final code.
Thank you very much, DG, as well as Chief Director. This really the important briefing we've got on the code. Very exciting in terms of the challenges we identified in the past and our hopes to address by making these strategic interventions. But let me ask members if they have a comment, questions. I'm just going to start at the bottom and work up the Honourable McIntosh. Yeah, Honourable Albert, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Ariane, and Brasini. In that order, what? Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, one of the great memories, or not great, unhappy memories I have as a relatively small boy was my father's ability to trap in Pretoria, having to be prosecuted and pay a substantial fine because he employed a black operator on his crane, and that was a criminal offence in terms of the Travel Reservation Act. And that's one of the things that has impacted on my commitment to non-racialism, but also to upliftment, and my father obviously wanted to give that black man an opportunity to get ahead in his house. But I think the Director General's reassurance that this is a work in progress is very encouraging. I really have a sense of discomfort about this kind of legislation, and I think we had a very good presentation by Normanda, if I may use your first name, no bitch statement. And I think there's some improvements. There are two things I think we've got to bear in mind. One is, how do we develop what I suppose I grew up with thinking of all the names, natives, non-Europeans, Bantu, Boers, now PDIs. How do we address the legitimate requirement that our country gives people who have previously been disadvantaged more opportunities? I think that's the challenge. And the challenge is, how do we do it without re-racializing our society? So I think, Madam Chair, just say that I have very levels of discomfort when I have to deal with this legislation, because on the one hand it's comforting, but on the other hand it is unacceptable. It's going to cost certain thresholds. The other element which, and I've got a question on that, because you've got a law coming soon. This is not a law. This is a code. But the law, as I understand it, that was proposed, was endeavour to effectively make this code legally enforceable and even introduce a criminalisation element, which gave me even more concerns. And what I need to know is, if it's going to be a code, but not a law, is this a way to avoid legal challenges? In two respects. One is in our constitution, and the second one is from the WTO, and in terms of our trade agreement internationally. Because just like in the Olympics, no crisis, you can't have any racial element in the Olympics. So it's the individual who qualifies with his or her own achievement. Similarly, I think that principle applies in international trade as well. So that's my question, and I just want to say, Madam Chair, that I think, Madam Chair, we all understand, as South Africans, that this is the sort of thing we've got to deal with the utmost sensitivity.
Thank you, Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I always ask this committee one question, and the question is basically, will it work? South Africa has huge challenges with regard to poverty, and I know this is part of that process to try and alleviate or eradicate poverty in the middle of the day and bring more people into the middle class and even hopefully more upwardly mobile as well. And I would like to know, first of all, if there has been any research on this changed code and how it will impact and how it will affect the objectives of eradicating poverty at the end of the day. Secondly, it's interesting to note that the BE targets are linked also with the affirmative action targets. Now, we know that the government has said many times from Labour Department's point of view that democratic representativity is quite important. Now, what is a little bit disconcerting for me, and latches onto what my honourable colleague had said before, is that if you're 100% black-owned in a EME, then you get extra points. But if you're 100% white-owned, then obviously you're not going to get points. Now, if you want to employ people on a democratic representativity basis, then you cannot expect a company to be 100% black. It will also penalize or bad for the company to be 100% black, given that due to our history, most people with experience are unfortunately white. But what it means is that if we do allow white managers in a predominantly black company, they can add value and they can also put themselves in a mentorship position to help the company to be successful. So I think if you're going to say that that there must be employment in terms of representativity on a demographic basis, then the management must also reflect that, and that a 100% black-owned company should actually endeavor to employ white people as well, so that there could be a balance. But what is happening in the market out there right now, and there is some research to support that, is that many experienced white managers don't find jobs and go overseas, which is a loss of South Africa. And I think if they are somehow accommodated in the process, and also allowed to be employed, let's say in black majority-owned companies, then obviously they can play a part in building the economy, and obviously that also speaks to going to a non-racial, a non-racist society in the end of the day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Elvis. We have, I just can't see the person concerned. Honourable Adele.
Thank you, Secretary. I think that the first of all, the President has to welcome this presentation. Why is it so important? Because I think that it is anchored on the constitution of the country. I like the background, the philosophical background of this code, is that they take the historically disadvantaged people into the mainstream of the economy. That one is critical. Because it remains the constitutional imperative that we as a democratic parliament, we must ensure that those people who marginalized before are at the mainstream of the economy. But at the same time, the very same constitution does not also encourage, as the Honourable Albert has said now, that we must marginalize those who are historical advantage. So what is critical is that we have to merge the two so that we can build a country and a productive economy. On that regard, I really appreciate this presentation. But what is also critical important is the revised waiting when coming to the issue of enterprise and supply development. That is get 40 points. Because I think that the problem with the past code was that it was very trying to redistribute the cake which is already there. So when this revised high cake, there's an attempt now to increase the cake, because if the cake is increased, it means that there's more sharing in the process. But what is very important, Jefferson, here, is the new trajectory which they are alluding to, that this course will go head in hand with the Industrial Policy Action Plan, which is very important. One of the key elements of the Industrial Policy Action Plan is to ensure that we industrialize our economy. So the question now which will arise, let's say we have 100% black-owned company, 100% black-owned company. By the method that its turnover is going to be between 5 million and 10 million, it's going to be 100% compliant and it's going to be exempted. But that company is an importer. It is an importer. It imports the goods instead of manufacturing the goods. So in the process of importing, the law of the company, but it undermines the bigger picture, that of growing, industrializing the country. Will that issue not factor in so that small companies cannot get this overwhelming score as it moves forward? Because it would undermine the bigger picture, Mr. Obama. Number two, Chair, also the emphasis on the skills development, alright, is very important because there's no enterprise. I recall one person once said that the people are not good in enterprise development because they don't take risk. That's what I tried some time back. But what is critical here, is the issue of opportunity. It is very critical. The issue of opportunity because you really take a risk in the field in which you are comfortable in the field which you understand. But with this 25 strategic engagement which has undertaken in the department, there's one flaw which is coming up in the whole skills issue. I'll take for example, I'm more oriented towards natural sciences now. I'm interested in the professions like engineering now. I had a lot of engagement with the sector. But now to the people who are historically disadvantaged in those things, you find that no matter how much money the government is pumping in education, in the field of engineering. But if one place comes out of that, they can go to the university, but equally, for them to get a qualification in that field, they must go and get experiential training, whereby the voluntary engineering associations are the ones who determine how many people are going to qualify that year. I think that if you go to the government center and check that, the amount of engineering produced per annum is very low. It's not the information. So did you engage in this specific engagement, not with the engineering council, but go to the people who receive those things at the end, like the South African Student Congress, who go out and check with them how much frustration they got in order to qualify. That's why the previous approval was proposed by the Department of Education in 2008 is very critical to the project, because you find that you go to voluntary applications to mechanical engineers, those guys will go in the program and decide that in this year, 2014, how many engineers are going to qualify in the mechanical engineering sector. So one of that situation of the nature, whereby the voluntary association, the command, the output is very dangerous. So I think that people are going to empower these people. We must also go and uncover that level. In a strategic engagement, I suggest that you put another specific strategic engagement, going to the higher education institutions, and get the start of the strength, not the size of the professor, the size of the student. Because when you do the constitution, I know a lot of African students who qualify to do engineering in the state tech, so that if you take an advice, get out of engineering, go into education. You find that they are qualifying, they are passing, but they were squeezed, you know that. So if you take a look on that side, the issue of skills development will be very critical. Thank you, Chef.
Please,
will you take
the Honourable
Mabarak,
please?
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair. Thanks to the team led by the DG and for the input. My first question, actually my first comment follows on what Comrade Khadebe has been having on, because there was a stage when we had to meet engineers, and the engineers did all in their power to try to get black engineers to accompany them to the meeting, you know, so that it's a respectable forum. They couldn't get them, and when we engaged, they were saying that no, they don't pass, they don't have the invite entry levels, and but I said, you know, if we continue this way, because it was in a mining company, then it means we are not going to transform South Africa, because it means we are still practicing job reservation in a certain way. But that's one comment. The other comment is that on the slide that speaks of the bodies that have been consulted, I don't see, unless I'm missing it, I don't see a body of people with disabilities consulted. Because that's a critical element. And then my other point was also to comment on the spreading out of the requirements that have to be met. To say that all of them have to be met, you know, just like colleague Khadebe said, so that people don't just focus on one to the detriment of the others. So that overall approach is a good approach. But South Africa is challenged, because it means South Africa must embrace this act so that as a country we are able to move forward. I'm saying this because we also have the areas like the farming areas, the agricultural areas. Those are some of the areas where if we don't produce black, highly skilled people, then we will end up with a country that does not produce enough food for itself. Just as an example. But thanks for the input that has been made, and the cooperative bodies, on the bodies that have been consulted, I don't see them consulted. Because I think that there should be a very close relationship between the development of this act as well as the development of cooperative act, because the two share a certain niche, so that if that is taken care of, it will address many factors that would otherwise escape us. Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mbaka. Honourable Ariane Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First of all, let me do. Sorry?
Madam Chairman.
Yeah, it's Nailed. First of all, let me congratulate the presentation, which was complete, accurate, and competent, and that's always a reflection. Secondly, let me congratulate you, if I can be so bold, for this opportunity, because I think it's very important that while we consider a new legislative framework, we come to terms with how the existing legislative framework has been implemented. Because the present legislative framework is one which is a blanket check to the executive, and it could have been implemented in one way, in the other the way. And now that we are called upon reinforcing, strengthening that legislative framework by means of enforcement mechanism, criminal actions, etc., we need to understand what it is that is being reinforced and what it is that the enforcement proceedings and litigating capacity and the criminal action apply to. And I think what we received today is a fair representation of where the system is at and where it's moving to. What we don't know, as members of Parliament, nor us know, is where the minister will take it in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, because we are leaving a blanket check to develop it as it is necessary. The type of development that we are seeing now are the expression of their statement of present day. The basically down the road, they will probably make a different assessment, and they will continue to change, tweak, and possibly improve on the system. And this is the first concern that we have in looking at what we have before as now. It is now. There's no bearing on what it could be in 5 years and 10 years. And this we need to keep in mind when we give it. When we look at the legislation of whether or not we should have relinquished Thomas Power in what remains the most fundamental and burning issue to the South African dilemma. The point one. I look at this, and when I looked at this the last time around, I gave the DDG an illegal opinion. And we would have some conclusions. It's an independent legal opinion produced by an independent academic was trained to analyze the system and he reached certain conclusions. The DG could react to me at the time and he said, well, we'll get back to you the next time around, which is now. The difficulty I have is that we are understanding we are experiencing something never done before in the history of mankind, based on my knowledge. While affirmative action programs have been quite well known since the 18th century, they've always been performed for the benefit of a minority, and more often than not, a small minority. This is the first experience in recorded history where an affirmative action program is developed for the benefit of 95 to 97% of the population, 93 to 95% of the population. So the question arises, which is a necessary question, which has not been addressed, and I'm trying to bring to the fore what happens to the non-favored. Are the people who are not favored, protected, and advantaged discriminated against? In usual programs of affirmative action, they are not, because they are the majority, and the benefit extended to a small minority can be absorbed by a majority without that majority being significantly affected and surely not discriminated against. I gave a legal opinion which indicates that the non-protected people, the people that nobody wants to refer to as white people, and as my friend Graham says, it's very difficult to go through this classification. I feel a little more freer than many others here because I arrived here after the old mix had finished. But I look at white people, and in terms of the documents I gave you, they will be not in the position, in terms of this amendment, will not be in the position of conducting economic activities in South Africa as white people. So this is a very difficult statement for me to digest. So I accept all of the mistakes, but I cannot accept what seems to be the intentional ignorance in terms of ignoring the flip side of the coin, and what is a position which is neither morally acceptable, not constitutionally acceptable, and sure, not within the parameters of what was agreed to, understood at the World Trade Center, where I had for good or evil, for better or worse, 10 years of my life negotiating this very issue. So we cannot ignore this side, because it's going to come back and bite the all of us, and some has been done, in terms of making an entire system not working. We need to go back and re-look at the terms of the overall constitutional, economic and social settlement, and whether it is done by means of the very technique that Professor James was suggesting, which is that of forget about race, look at economics, people with money, black diamond or otherwise, there is no point in empowering Mr. Ramaphosa and Mr. Sequoia, with the good intent of this legislation. So if we took the Dr. James approach, all we have heard today is to be recast completely. It needs to be thrown out the window, we need to go back to the drawing board. If we go through the approach to James, that one of my colleagues, who have a deadline, which was in one of the preceding bills, where it would apply only to previously disadvantaged people, which means those who entered the education system before 1994, so that my son's black school colleague is placed in no position to be better off than my own child, because virtually when they're going to the same school, they're receiving the same education, one is black, one is white, they play together. They are not sense of being different. Why should we make them different? If they get out of school and they compete on terms of the same education opportunity for the lower economic opportunity level. This is another approach which has been created and has been abandoned. So unless we grapple with these real issues, looking how the system gets tweaked a little better, a little worse, or reinforcing the legislation to give it I think we are not doing our job, and that we are escaping what remains of Africa, more fundamental issue.
Thank you very much. Just thought I would comment at this point. I know that there were one or two others. I think what we need to keep in mind as we engage with the presentation on the codes, etc., It would be important for us to be mindful of the fact that notwithstanding this is directed, if you like, at the majority in terms of a demographic situation. That is correct. It is. But we cannot ignore that the bulk of the legislation up to the point of 1994, and then not too much was effectively changed in terms of economic legislation in this regard, did not effectively address what was effectively a legislated form of slavery or subservience, and which prevented the bulk of the population from such access. So because of that, no, not America, quite right. No, we're not other countries, really. affirmative action may have been directed at a minority. Ours is almost a unique situation in that respect. So without saying more, I would just ask all members to just take account of the history when engaging with the legislation itself. I just have two more hands. The Honourable Salah, yourself, Honourable James, at one point had your hand up, and then the Honourable Kwabasa.
Thanks, Senator. One must go back to the situation that we are dealing with a challenge that this country was once under a government that oppressed the majority for the minority. Those are hard facts that stand in front of us, and we have a challenge to change that environment to an environment where we are all equal before the law. It is the duty of Parliament to always be alive to the impact of law to society. And if Parliament is not able to do that, then that Parliament is as good as not having to exist. Now, what we do today, if the impact becomes negative to society at some point, such a law can still come back to Parliament for Parliament to amend in order to suit the conditions at the time. But this was changed. As the former president used to say, it's a concept very difficult to accept. It's a bitter thing. Change is not something that comes because you will behave about it. Change to the society happens because it has to happen. Whether nice or not nice, but it has to happen. Now, what we are grappling with here is change. And in this change, we are looking at the different concepts facing each other. The black empowerment versus the white oppression. The skills transfer versus the black development. The apartheid versus democracy. The commitment versus health and gain. The skills value versus employment availability. The revival of the past versus the status quo. And you can go on and on. And these things are all saying to us, they don't seem palatable on them. If something should happen, someone will not be necessarily comfortable. But that end is necessary. So what we need to look at here is not so much that everyone must be happy of the law that we should have made, but how much the law is fair to the building of the nation, and non-racial, non-racial, a member of a non-racial, non-racial, and democracy in this context. And what he's trying to do, I would agree with people saying, we need to be careful not to be seen to be reversing apartheid. And that in whatever we do, we need to be seen not to be reversing apartheid, to say, we have done good apartheid, therefore, you must now be oppressed at the expense of the black economic empowerment. That we must not be seen to be doing. But we can equally not be seen to be saying, it was fine, they benefited, let them continue to benefit. Black must continue to live it. Maybe the next generation that some will then change. We can't do that. We can't do that to get. We need to make that change. And what I am saying is that we have a presentation before us, very good presentation by the department, and from all that has been said, the only area that seems to be getting flagged by every speaker, without question, is the issue of not moving in a manner that we will be seen to be reversing apartheid, taking it from the white to the black, black oppressing the white. And I agree with that, Representative, that we should be careful with that, but this particular change is necessary and should be effective. Thank you, sir.
Honorable James.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'd like to make 3 points. First is that we do live in a historical context, and that context has probably shaped the distribution of wealth in this country. And that is the history of, it's a context that's been shaped by a history of asset stripping. And I don't want to make a moral point about that. I want to say that it is a fact that on the basis of race, there has been centuries of asset stripping in this country. And that the result of that is a level of inequality that would make our country not only unfair and unjust, but also very unstable if it continues. So that is our context. Secondly, I believe that since 1994 to today, 18 years of democracy, new forms of exclusion and inclusion has in fact emerged. That there are new boundaries and new barriers that have grown up, intended or not, between those who are on the inside of the system and those on the outside. And so this is a formal economy, an economy of inviters, and an informal economy, the size of which is subject to dispute. But an informal economy, and we said that people in that informal economy who have assets, but they have good assets. For example, living in an RMP home where they don't have legal title and they can't use it to borrow money in the bank. It's a good asset. So the challenge is to pull in the debt assets in this country into the formal economy. That's the challenge. And I think that what we have before us is a device that can do that. And I would like to see that device deal with the past, recognize the present, and create opportunities for the future, because this is principally to use assets in order to add value to it so that we can create opportunities for small business in particular heading into the future. Because if you want 5 million jobs, you need a million more small business in a country known for having large corporations. So the purpose, in my view, of this legislation would be to create opportunities, recognizing what has happened in the past. And it has to be aimed at small business, not large business. It can't be that. Otherwise, we simply will reproduce the corporate structure and the concentration of wealth in class terms at the upper level. We need to grow an entrepreneurial class of people. The final point I would like to make is that in the spirit of our constitution and so on, I would like this to be as non-racial as possible. And it can be non-racial given the structure of the categories in ways that it will not be easy to get right, but it's possible. It's possible to have the socioeconomic development component be non-racial. If you look at the revised BBBEE scorecard, and you start at the bottom of the five categories, it's possible for socioeconomic development component to be a non-racial one. If you go one up, it's possible to have enterprise development be a non-racial one as well. It's a bit more tricky with supplier development. You collapse it into one category. But it's possible to do that. And it's in fact essential, if you go one step up, for the skill development to be non-racial. Everybody should have opportunities to gain skills. You need to generate a pipeline of human beings with talent and entrepreneurial spirit to be the new owners in the future. And how do you do that? Everybody must benefit. It cannot be racially based. Management control, however, cannot be partial. It would be very difficult to deal with it. I would like to see that being non-racial as well, but I can see how difficult that would be. And ownership on an equity level, it's the same point. So the hardest thing to make non-racial would be ownership, equity, and control. But skill development, enterprise development, and socioeconomic development can be entirely non-racial. So you invest in the future on a non-racial basis, and you recognize what has happened in terms of asset stripping on a racial basis. But a final point is that it is not possible to change that. There has to be a sunset clause in it. You cannot do it forever. That if you could possibly put a timeline on it, say 10 years, and you scale it down. That is, as people meet the requirements, you change the scorecard along the way. So you can scale it down and out of the system. So, as an initial set of comments, if I'd like to make those.
Thank you very much. Honourable Jane. Honourable Kumbanda.
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much. I also want to express appreciation for this input and pray that indeed it takes us a lot more further if it achieves the objective as set out. I think that then we must build into it. I think Honourable James was alluding to that as well. We must build to it stages of evaluation so that we know how much we are progressing in achieving the objectives that this code of good practice needs to achieve. The second point, the person I need to make is that this portfolio committee, like all other portfolio committees, has a responsibility. A responsibility of ensuring the attainment of a non-racial economy, which eventually leads us to a non-racial society. A non-racial and a prosperous society. And for that to happen, as Comrade Bilal has said, we must keep cognizant of the history we come from. Because otherwise we will behave as if history started in 1994 in South Africa. As some of the comments seem to allude. The fact that your child, Honorable Amrosini, and mine are going to the same school today does not negate the fact that my child comes from an economically disadvantaged background. And that will take probably 20 to 40, 50 years to change. But we must start now to change that. I'm emphasizing the point that this portfolio committee has this responsibility. I'm not picking on you personally, Honorable Amrosini. I'm waiting to use the white flag story. But also, we must remember that we have a responsibility to pursue inclusive shared growth. And this code of good practice is aimed at achieving precisely that. The if this is similar to the debate of the land issue, unless we redistribute it in a manner that allows black people who are dispossessed of land, we will never be able. Because the issue of land is an economic question as well. And that's why I'm leaving it to this. The issue of land speaks also to the issue of the ownership of the productive, of the means of production. It's an economic issue. And so we need to look much broader than that. And that's why it must be appreciated that this input links the cost of good practice to the Industrial Policy Action Plan, the New Growth Pact, and by implication, the New Development Plan as well. So we must reverse the imbalances of the past in order to achieve inclusive and shared growth. Otherwise, we risk, and allow me to say this, Chairperson, as I conclude, we risk a new revolution in which nobody will be able to control. A revolution in whose consequences, which will be worse than what we experienced before 1994. And the tendency is always to think that if that happens, the ruling party will be voted out of power and hooray, the next party will take over. When that happens, no political party will win, and no political party will take control of that situation. And I think the signs are there, and we must be alert to that. Thank you.
We've had that. I'm sure you've heard all of the responses to that, DG, the director. I'm now going to ask you to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I take it that many of the comments were really comments and really were sort of advice to the department and some. So I think I'm not going to spend too much time addressing those things. We're really trying to address some of the questions, some of the key concerns, and some of the suggestions that have been made. I think that if one maybe kicks off with the first group of speakers, Mr. McIntosh, Mr. Alves, I think that they were really drawing our attention to the fact that they're supportive of the thrust of the or where we're heading, there is a concern that maybe we're re-racializing the country and maybe we also criminalizing, especially if one links it to the change to the bill and so on. I think I think that Mr. Alves' question was also, are we really then through this having any impact on poverty and on the real problems and so on. I'd like to just make two responses to that. The first thing is, I think there's a changes in the bill. Firstly, we're criminalizing fronting and illegal and fraudulent behavior, but we're not criminalizing bad performance. So if you get a level 8, no problem with you. You're not going to be penalized for that. But if you do lie about the status and you say, I'm a black company, this and this I do, and get a government contract and you don't, that is where the penalties kick in. I think it's very important that the code of good practice remains that where you score is up to you, but of course if you do score higher, there are certain commercial advantages that flow to you once you do that, and that is the principle of the scorecard. The second thing is with the Alves point about addressing poverty, and it relates to what Honourable Member James also raised about, are we dealing with this real problem of increasing poverty, increasing inequality, increasing dualism in our economy? I think that as we said at the start, the code and the act is really, while it's not so much about the moral imperative or just redressing the past, it's really an economic issue. Now, what we said, the key problem of our economy is there's a small, not only a small middle class, but there's a small entrepreneurial class. If you take the size of our population and our economy, you'll see a small number of small and medium-sized firms in our economy. If you take any country, whether it's Japan or Germany, call it in Germany the middle stunt. There's a large part, it's not BMW, but there's a large part of small, medium, family-owned businesses that form the heart of that economy. That is missing in South Africa. We just have a few large corporates dominating each sector. So what we must, and the reason for that is because we've underdeveloped the supply side of our economy. So it's not just of ownership and what's it, Phase Law. Supply creates demand. Because black people were not suppliers and owners of small businesses, you can't create demand. So that's why we're saying by emphasizing supply and development, we are trying to broaden the base of this economy. So therefore, I think that will have the best impact on poverty, employment, and so, and I think Mr. Khadebe linked this thing about we must release this with IPAC. It's the same initiative with that. So I don't think we should be concerned about de-racializing the economy. We actually, by broadening and creating access for the bulk of the population into a bigger and more productive economy. I think I've emphasized Honourable Member Khadebe Mabasa, I think just on the question of consultation, we with regard to disabilities, we have consulted, maybe not as much with the groups, but we did consult the National Department of Women, Children and Disabilities. There was extensive consultation with this, and as you, with regard to that element. I think also, I think we take, we, Honorable Khadebe, the question of, I think, the engineering issue you raised about the toast shops or the guilds, you know, people trying to control access. I think we'll definitely look at that under the skills issue. I think that the other point you raised, Ms. Honorable Member Khadebe, is the question of if you're 100% black importer, do you qualify? I think that we just often in NEDLAC as well. That somehow we must say, and sometimes people sometimes try to equate black entrepreneurs with just being importers. As you can see, the fact is obviously to make it suppliers and so on. But I don't think one must, you see, any economy relies on imports. So 25, and in our context, over 25% I think is imports. And you can't do that because your economy doesn't have all that it needs. So you can't say that people can't engage now in some imports and so on. As I said, the bulk of our program is to develop local producers. But I think so. We'll maybe explore that in a bit more detail and look at how we especially with funding. You know what I mean? You all you do is just import and you replace let's say a white local manufacturer. I think there probably is something we can look at. That I think I remember Mbasa. I think. The issue co-ops, I think you raised very stridently, and I think that, as I said, the work on the co-op legislation and program is linked to this, but I think the, I don't know, maybe we can strengthen it or Lamont can cover it, but co-ops, the key beneficiary is, as we said, is to bring people into the market, to give them access to markets, and co-ops is key, I think, in that process, along with small businesses. And so on, and bringing them into the supply chain as well. So I think that's why we have it. I think, Honourable Member, on the embassy's points, I have our chief director here next to me is a lawyer. So we have the legal opinion for proper legal analysis and so on. I won't be able to, at this point, give a full briefing. But it's interesting that I think the one point is that we are not in a unique situation where we're the first country in the world where empowerment, affirmative action is for the majority. I think if you take, as I mentioned the last time, Malaysia, where the Bumiputra is the majority in the population, and the Chinese were the owners of let's say, 100% of the ownership under British rule. But as I said, the one point with Malaysia, the Bumiputra is now in the mainstream of the economy. So they've solved the problem. They've not only solved the Bumiputra exclusion problem, they are now an advanced industrial economy, less than 5% unemployment, high value add, middle income country, and so on. So they simultaneously, but what they did it immediately. And secondly, they were much more, assertive than our laws are. They made it a rule, it was compulsory to allow Bumiputra into the mainstream and so on. But as I said, they've succeeded, they're a stable country now. All the big riots they used to have between Malays and Chinese in the 60s have been wiped out and so on. So I think there is a successful case of successful transformation, and I think that's the example. Maybe we can't copy it fully, but I think we can learn lessons from the Malaysian experience. But I also think that we don't really, I think the one point we must take from Ambrosini is that we don't have to create now marginalization of white entrepreneurs. We must actually use the, as I said, we are endowed with the rich resource of very skilled, very dynamic entrepreneur, as was mentioned, the deal by NASPERS, where one of our, introduced a very innovative BE program. It's one of the best performing BE deals that the NASPERS done by Quotec, and there we drew it. You draw on the expertise of our let's say our white industrialists and white entrepreneurs. And so I don't think it's marginalization taking place, and as the surveys indicate, there's no let's say marginalized of white business people in our economy. They are still thriving, they are still really contributing to our overall economic development. I see that then if I can come to Honourable Dane's suggestions, I think maybe I'll ask the money to comment, but I think that actually those suggestions sound quite let's say on top of it, looks quite useful, because I think if you can actually do skills, I mean, I think it makes sense that one can, any skills development will be good for the country. And as I said, maybe we can look at a way of saying you, for any skills you do, it doesn't matter on the race of the person, you get points for that. I think that can definitely work in that area, and in socioeconomic development. But as I said, we also just don't want things where, for example, things are 100% just very exclusionary type of activities. We might just say that we don't, people don't stay in the Stone Age, that there is some change in the things we reward and so on. But I think it's definitely, I mean, and maybe that way we can have a much more meritocratic and a much more non-racial element to it. I think I really welcome those suggestions, and we will definitely look at where we can put it in. And then I think the question of the subject clause is, I think it came up when we passed the act about 10 years ago. And I think what we said then, and I think it probably applies now, I think it's probably useful to do, you can't carry on forever with this, and especially not on the National Development Plan of 2030, that we're still going to debate these sort of really, the codes again. So I think we really must see, obviously we may not say the timelines to it, maybe we should set objectives in 10 years, 2025, we should try to finish this BE story. Maybe that is objective. Obviously, if we don't achieve it, that then, as Honourable Member Kwabasa says, if we don't also deal with these problems, we might not have a parliament to come back to. But I think there is merit in setting very targeted of objectives to that. I think maybe in the Monday and people to.
Well, I think the one that we didn't cover from Honorable Albert, the one about the research, whether it was any research done.
Oh.
The resolution was saying the code of practice were accepted in 2007, implemented, and in 2008 there was some kind of a scan of the performance in terms of implementation. That was done by the transnational group, and it was really at the that time that the performance in terms of all the elements of the scorecard, the problem is not familiar. It was only, I think, the ownership elements that was because of all the big transactions, the mining area. But then we instituted another round of research in 2012. We're going to be getting the results, I think, at the end of February, beginning of March. The universities are helping us in terms of, you know, scanning the current again, what's the performance in terms of all these seven elements of the scorecard. And that helped us, I mean, to refine the new course going forward.
That covers most of it. Madam Chair, as I said, we will take into account. Just to make the final point that I think the slide that Namandi showed is that, and because of the structure of our economy, as was mentioned down earlier with James as well, we've got a very, very, as I said, we've got a few large firms dominating our economic landscape, all our industries. Like steel is just one or two producers, you take retail, there's four, everywhere you go, the same problem, several dominates chemicals and so on. So that's really the problem in any other country. They have a large, small, medium-sized sector, which we lack in this country, because what they did in South Africa, because of the exclusion, they imported those products. So for example, you take Toyota, even in Thailand now, but in Japan, they produce almost 80 to 90% of the vehicle is produced in. If you take the assembly, you know, we only do the assembly, 65-70% of the parts are imported. So that's the whole question about industrialization, small businesses. supply big businesses, and that's the value chain we're trying to create. But really, the response we're really focusing on is the 2%, which is where, I mean, it's probably, I mean, as I said, there's these 10,000 to 11,000 firms. They have the muscle, they have the market share at the moment, and always they are the ones who must comply with scorecards, and they must, integrate black businesses into their supply chain and so on. And that's really what we're saying. So the others are really, that's why we've exempted them, the smaller enterprises. It's not really fundamental. The ones who can really transform our economy are these 10,000 enterprises.
So, Chief, coming to you, want to make any further comments on this? Just a minute. I was coming back to some follow-ups. You know, I don't want to introduce a high noon here where I've got to reach for the something immediately. But there was follow-up. But then there was also a question from yourself, am I right, Honorable Oriani, I was seeing. So, first, that those two of you who feel that and your own questions already raised were not effectively dealt with. Honorable McIntosh, Honorable Elvis.
Madam Chair, not a follow-up. Just, I did ask a question about the legalities. I thought maybe Mr. Sikore was going to deal with it, but please. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Elvis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that there will be a economic study done on this, and we should have sight of that before we finalize these codes. Just on the application of these codes of the 2%, the other percentage is the 95% and 3%. They all form part of the economy and they form a complex system. And while you, as the Director General correctly said, there's no criminalization of not compliance, but fighting and all those things, circumventing the law, that's criminalized. What has happened is that because of the onus put on large companies, the onus filters down to the other companies as well. And what happens is that large companies expect all companies to be compliant somehow, even if they don't have to be by law. That is what happens de facto. So, and I hope that comes out in the study as well. What then happens is that many people are forced out of the market. Many entrepreneurs are forced out of the market based on race. And that's why I was arguing, amongst others, that we talk about a 100% black company, that a company that is not completely 100% black, but is, that it does have a minority component of 10% as well, must also be given the same scoring. To allow for minorities to come into the market as well and to be partners with black people in the marketplace. The second reason for saying this is that if government makes a policy and makes laws, it must be consistent, it must be fairly and equitably applied to everyone. So if you say that you use the marker of demographic representativity, then that must be applied not only in affirmative action, but it must be applied in DEE as well. So when a company then reflects on its management levels and well, based on all its levels, if it reflects then the democratic representativity, it should not be given a lower rating because it actually complies with government policy. So if you say no, but you must 100% black, that would be inequitable as far as I'm concerned, and I don't think it will pass any legal challenge to that as well. So if we talk about inclusive economy, at the very least I want to ask government to apply its own policies consistently and legally. Thank you.
Honorable Oriani Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make the frame, if I can just reiterate my question and then with your permission make a short additional comment. But I would like to make both against the premise that I have held in many committees, perhaps not as extensively as many of my colleagues. I have a mere 7 days a week. And really I've seen a debate taking place in four things in air. Air, the air is there, yeah. we are all listening to one another. You could hear a pin drop. And because we know that we are dealing with something important, no one here is being irresponsible. No one here is being unaware of what this debate means. And I wish the debate, the time came to the table and spoke to us with the same gravitas with which this debate has been approached. I ask a very simple question, on which I receive no answer. Would it be a common cause in understanding the facts of what all this means? It's immensely complex. I mean, that by itself shows how much more business will be complicated. I bother to have a legal opinion drafted by independent expert, and I ask, is it correct? Or if it's not correct, where is it incorrect? And I did not do so merely because if it is incorrect, I'll answer my own back. But I did so to try to reach a common ground, a common understanding on what the implications are. So I do want an answer. I think I'm entitled to have an answer, a serious answer, an analytical answer, to a serious and to an analytical.
What I'd like to do is get that question. You see, I'm not privy to the committee.
I just read it to everyone last week, at the last meeting on this matter. And it has been distributed, and at the last meeting, the DDG said, it's too complex, we'll get back to you at the next meeting. This is the next meeting, obviously they haven't bothered reading it. At the next meeting, I would like to have the answer. Because then if I am moving from wrong premises, and it could be so also, and then I can shut up. But if my premises are legally correct, then let's face what things mean. Look at the legal level. At the moral level, I need to understand, who could help me understand? Because if I understand, other people understand. I do not believe that we legislate for other people. I mean, when we start taking the approach that what we legislate for doesn't affect all of us, and we ourselves are not the primary reference of the legislation, we undermine the very notion of democracy. We are representative of people, and as such, we need to relate what we legislate to ourselves. So if our two children are going to the same school, if to you, Madam Chairman, I don't want to personalize, but let's look at a real life example. Our children are going to the same school. We got the same job. We sit in the same job. We're making the same money. We, many of my black colleagues have much more money than I have, and I can mention many of them. I've been here 20 years, private life, much better opportunities to them. What is the moral value in giving my child less opportunity than the child of my colleague who sits here, who has more money than I do, who has more opportunity than I do? Why is his child disadvantaged as opposed to mine? Now, if it's been said legal simply, it would be a red race. But how does that happen to our own circumstances? And I need to put my mind around this moral problem. And many other people do. Because if that cannot be solved, then we need to look at basis other than racial basis. Or race with something else. Race with poverty. And the same goes for the 760,000 white people below the poverty line. Why? What legacy does it need to be addressed? What capital they accumulated is now there on subsidies and quarter camps, etc. What is the moral part of the justification? And the same goes with the freedom crackers. Why should our chairperson pay a price for being white? We should have paid a huge price. What value has she accumulated? And what grandchildren? What value has grandchildren accumulated? And this is crucial. We are legislating for us as we are legislating for other people. And I might be wrong, but I just want to hear the moral justification from my colleagues and my friends that can explain to me.
Honourable Oriani Ambrosini, The letter, along with everything else, for this meeting would normally have been here, but for those of us who inadvertently didn't bring it along, but it will be here shortly. I should just indicate that. Honourable Khadeli?
Thank you, Honourable. It's just a follow-up from the response of the DG. In particular, in connection with the issue of the sunset clause, I've got a serious problem with that. With the issue of the sunset clause on the issue of black economic empowerment. Because, one, as long as there are racial disparities in this country, we have to address that. So we cannot put a time frame. Even if coming to the original BEE Act, if we were mechanical, if we were mechanical, as we were with the issue of the land restitution, there were certain multiple issues of contract on the plan. I tell you that one. Because before 1913, there was land dispossession during that time. But our founders in 1994 to 1996, they decided that they were going to use 1913 as the baseline because it was then that an organized official land grab was designed. Therefore, so there is a reason for that. If we were mechanical about that, we could have said that in 1910, the majority of the people were excluded. They were only going to be included in 1994. It means that they had a backlog of 84 years. We could have said no from 94 up to 2078. There must be BEE all along. But that one will not have helped. That one will not have helped. What is critical here is that we as South Africans, we must work so hard in such a way that we ensure that these banks are eliminated as quickly as possible. So once we start putting the better clauses, then we are going to start being artificial with that one. Because once we want the process, we don't want to have the end product whereby the black majority is going to be the dominant force and the white are going to be the minority force. That we don't want. We want a society where the people are going to get equal opportunity, equal share in the economy. That the issue of the sunset clause already discouraged the department to consider that. I think that is very difficult. Is that we must eliminate the discrimination of the past and ensure that we are living in a thriving society. I like the example of Malaysia. Malaysia is thriving now because people don't look each other, because they want to lack opportunities. People are going to start to look each other negatively. So what we must do now, must ensure that we promulgate, that's why. That 47th point, I really like it, because there's a chance of broadening the economic aid, not as the job of everyone. So, but that job, not only for the black people for government, it's for every South African. That's why the party, which I come from, once set in 1956, South Africa belongs to all the who live in it, black and white. That's why Madiba, 1964, even before I was born, he said, I fought against white domination, I fought against black domination. I think those principles are the ones that guide us as we are moving forward now. And then on the issue, Chair, which was raised by Honorable Ambrosini, Chair, I don't think this thing which we are doing here is what he's thinking about. It's not the same. Because really, I'll make an example. Right now, as we are speaking, one of the empowerment rules, which is used by the government, is self development, high education access. When you get higher education now, you go to university, the majority of students that are black, it affects. But how is it happening? It's simply because the government gives an opportunity for those guys who don't go there an opportunity. How come the state national financial aid scheme? When you qualify for that, then definitely, this is my own child. We're not going to qualify because there's a real test before and try to qualify for that. So even if in a white child, whatever, he or she will be able to gain the access to those funds. So we're not being mechanical. We're not being mechanical for the funds. But the issue that this government is irresponsible is going to ensure that we transform the economy as quickly as possible. But everyone must come to the party. But how do we come to the party? We must recognize that we have the problematic past. But we must work today so that tomorrow we do not have the same situation we had in the past. Thank you.
E.G., let me just say one or two points and then please if you would comment. Look, I think the triple B, double E, there was at least some board acknowledgement from all members here, even those who raised very serious issues about their reservations, and that this is indeed a recognition of some of the challenges experienced in the past with the code, with the sort of attempts in this direction. And this is, you know, a realistic attempt to try and address that in a measured way within our constitutional framework and guidelines. And that we do have to recognize that we have to have economic transformation. I won't refer to the dangerous keg that we're all sitting on if we continue to delay economic transformation. And that does require radical surgery. However, I would just remind the DG, you did refer to the NDP yourself, or someone did, and that indeed all these codes and everything else will be under review there. How well did they achieve their targeted outputs? Do they need further change in this direction? What are the results of this? And I think that in itself, if you like, it's sunset clause, if you want to put it that way. It is going to be seriously reviewed. And we all agree, I think, in principle with the NDP itself. So I think what we need to do is contextualize it within our own country as history, as the Honourable James has said. But at the same time, be mindful of where such initiatives may have been implemented elsewhere. And yes, we are working carefully in this direction. And we are mindful of the concerns of young white South Africans. Yes, we are. That is why this does not seek to adopt an exclusionary approach, but rather, while being inclusive, to recognize reality. And we cannot ignore that. And I just want to call to members to try and, I think some of you have put forward some proposals which could be considered, and to see how these may assist with the concerns you have. And I think we must continue to unpack these. But DG, just the last word, and then members, we'll go for tea.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think that the contextual remarks you made at the end, I think, covers some of the points that was raised. I think it's going to, let me stick to the questions then, very briefly. On McIntosh's point, I think with regards to the WTO issue, as I indicated the last time, the key issue on the WTO is the question of national treatment, which is regulated by WTO, which means that you can't discriminate between foreign firms and national firms. As I said, in terms of our BE codes, we are fully compliant with WTO, with all our trade treaties, because we don't discriminate with regard to the use of the scorecard, procurement, whether you're foreign or local, we don't ask that question. The question is, as I said, they're all treated equally, and in fact, foreign firms are given slightly more flexibility because they can use equity equivalents. Which is not available to local firms. So I have no concern around WTO compliance. On the question of Honourable Albert's point, I think it's very important to distinguish between the beneficiaries and who we want to use the scorecard. Our target for ownership remains 25%. We say a company to score in the ownership, you must over a period like that 25% black ownership. Where the 100% ownership comes in is that if I'm a black small business and I'm just the owner of my, and I employ five people, then everything is, because you're 100% black owned, you don't have to go and do this ticket scorecard, get a verification agency to come and check how black you are and so on, to really, you just automatically qualify. That is, so it's they are the beneficiaries we try to bring into the mainstream and so on. But as I said, because we're still exempting small enterprises, that applies to white or black enterprises, so there's no... but I think to reassure, because our economy is growing, and also because
because we have a range of other incentives to stimulate, for example, the manufacturing sector, which is unfortunately still 95% white-owned in terms of South Africa ownership. There has been very little, so there has been very little marginalization of groups. In fact, the opposite is the case. There's been too little empowerment of black suppliers and so on. So really, I don't think in the majority of sectors you have a problem of marginalization of white entrepreneurs. And there could be other areas of marginalization, but not, as I said, in the economic sphere. And then finally, turning to Honourable Member Ambassini's point, first on the legal opinion. As I said, because we wanted to give it the seriousness it deserves, we looked at it and discussed it in the department, but we also then referred it to Paul Benjamin, our attorney working on this, to give a considered written legal opinion on that. But prima facie, and as I said, as an undergraduate law student, what we can say is that the one they just gave me was in a postgraduate law student. If you look at the Constitution, and as I said, it's in the Act, the B Act, Chapter 9, which has Chapter 2 of the Bill of Rights, and Section 9, equality, it says here, to promote the achievement of equality, legislative and other measures designed to protect or advance persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination may be undertaken. So it's a constitutionally sort of affirmative action policies fully endorsed in the Constitution. But more importantly, the Act is 10 years old. So if there was going to be a constitutional challenge to taking BEE measures, I think that really it would have been taken already. So I think there's no problem about the constitutionality of our Act. What we're really trying to do is now, and I think companies are already using this whole card, what we're trying to do is to maximize the benefits of the scorecard. So it's like somebody said, if the patient falls, don't blame the crutch. You know, there's many reasons why the patient can't walk. And we're not going into that, but what we have is we've designed an instrument to try to help this process. That instrument is the scorecard. We are trying to perfect this instrument, take up the unintended consequences, try to focus it and so on. So therefore, the question of us now introducing discrimination or something is not part of this debate. This debate is simply, we are saying, we have implemented certain measures over the past 10 years, we've learned some lessons from, we're trying to improve, but we can't then go to a whole debate about whether we should have BEE whilst we're discussing to perfecting the model and so on. So I mean, really, that's the answer to Mr. Ambrosini, but as I said, we are confident as a department that we are fully constitutional, that appeal that you gave us prima facie has no merit, but we will subject it to as I say, the legal opinion by our legal advisors that we give it.
Honourable Ambrosini, please put, don't raise your voice when it's not, you're not recognized. Don't do this.
I think we just found it on Minister Arnold Kadebe's point about the sunset clause. I think, again, as I said, I put a view, but I do think that was the initial point that was made, that we have to deal with the underlying problem of dealing with disparities. When we solve that problem, then obviously you don't need legislation. But as I said, that is a constant debate, the sunset clause.
No, we are going to adjourn the tea. Thank you.